This is Lesson 7 of Isaiah Part 1. Our focus today will be on Chapter 14, verses 28 to 32, and Chapters 15, 16, 17, and 18. Including our introductory class, we will spend 15 weeks on this study of the first 39 chapters of Isaiah. Including the introductory class, then, this is our eighth week, so this is the midpoint of the class. Therefore, it is appropriate to remind ourselves that we are studying the words of God given to mankind through the prophet Isaiah. The Lord gave him a vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and Isaiah's ministry extended over the reign of four kings of Judah. So far, we have seen that the first five chapters of the book, which set out the condition of God's people, occurred during the reign of Uzziah. Chapter 6, which records God's call on Isaiah and Isaiah's response, is the only chapter which takes place under the reign of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. Chapters 7 through 12 constitute a segment that covers the Lord's judgment of Israel for its unbelief, but it is a segment that is also known as the Book of Emmanuel because of the great promises within those chapters of the future Messiah. This segment was under the reign of Ahaz, the son of Jotham and the grandson of Uzziah. Beginning with chapter 13, the focus moves away from Israel alone and turns to the Lord's judgment of other nations, but it was still under the reign of Ahaz. The first nation to receive an oracle or verdict from the Lord through Isaiah was Babylon. This oracle extended from the beginning of chapter 13 through chapter 14, verse 27. Today we move into the last five verses of chapter 14, which contain the next oracle or verdict of God, this time against the nation of Philistia. While this is still part of the larger segment that begins at chapter 13 and goes through chapter 23 regarding the judgment of the nations, what changes at the beginning of chapter 14 is that now we are up to the reign of Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz. Thus, even though we are only up to chapter 14, we have now seen all four kings of Judah, and the rest of the book of Isaiah takes place under the reign of Hezekiah. As we turn to the last five verses of chapter 14, we are at the beginning of the reign of King Hezekiah because verse 28 tells us that Isaiah received the oracle regarding Philistia in the year that King Ahaz died. From extra-biblical sources, scholars have determined that that was around the year 715 BC. In the workbook on page 96, K. Arthur explains that the Philistines were a sea people that most historians believe migrated from the Aegean region to the coastland of Canaan after invading Egypt. From the time of the judges, the Philistines were the recorded enemies of Israel. The oracle, or the verdict, against Philistia begins with the command to stop rejoicing. Chapter 14, verse 29 says, "Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent." The first thing we need to understand is why Philistia was rejoicing. The answer comes from a passage in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, which provides the background. We have looked at this passage before. It takes place when Ahaz was still the king, and he sent to the king of Assyria for help because he was being attacked on all sides. From earlier chapters of Isaiah, we know that Aram, or Syria, had formed an alliance with Israel, the northern kingdom, and together they were attacking Judah, the southern kingdom, so that they could replace Ahaz with a puppet king whom they could control. But 2 Chronicles chapter 28 tells us that Ahaz's problems were not limited to this coalition from the north. From the southwest, the Edomites had come and attacked Judah and carried away captives. In addition, The Philistines also had invaded the Low Country and the Negev in the south, had taken several cities, six of which are named, and had settled there. Because Judah, the southern kingdom, was expending most or all of its energy dealing with the coalition of Aram and Israel on the north, it was unable to withstand the incursions by the Philistines and the Edomites. In the year that Ahaz died and Isaiah received this oracle or verdict, the Philistines were still in possession of the lands that they had taken from Judah. But this was to be the year in which their fortunes were reversed. Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, was about to recover not only the cities they had taken, but also he was about to defeat them in their own land. This is recounted in 2 Kings 18:8. This is why the oracle begins, "Do not rejoice, O Philistia." Let's work our way through the rest of this verse to see what it means. The rod that struck you is a reference to the scepter of David. David and his son Solomon had kept the Philistines in subjection, and this subjugation had been renewed under the reign of Uzziah, who was the grandfather of Ahaz. In the reign of Ahaz, however, the dominance of Judah over the Philistines had been broken. This was the cause of the rejoicing of the Philistines. The Lord warns the Philistines that the cause for their celebration is ended. Verse 29 continues, "For from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent." What does this mean? One possible interpretation is this. This verse compares the Davidic scepter to a serpent or a common snake, which, under the rule of David's descendant Ahaz, had died out down to its very roots. But out of these very roots, meaning out of the house of David, which at this point was very humbled, there would come forth a viper. This viper represents the Davidic government of the very near future. In other words, it represents the next king of the house of David, Hezekiah. The verse also says that the fruit of the viper will be a flying serpent. That represents the Davidic government of the ultimate future, the Messianic age. It represents the coming of the Messiah. Now, you may think that this is a problem because generally we think of a serpent as a symbol of evil. But a serpent is also a symbol of a curse, and a curse can be the expression of the justice of God. In the immediate circumstances, Philistia was about to experience such a curse in the form of God's judgment against it in the form of Hezekiah. And not only from Hezekiah, but also from Assyria. Let's look at the last three verses of chapter 14. Verse 30 says, "And those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security." That's a decree of safety for Israel. But for Philistia, the rest of verse 30 says, "I will destroy your root with famine, and it will kill off your survivors." Philistia would soon be a nation that was cut away down to the roots. Actually, it sounds as if even the roots would die. There would not even be a remnant. Verse 31 says, "Wail, O gate, cry, O city, melt away, O Philistia, all of you, for smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks." The gates, the cities, and the people of Philistia would melt in the heat of the burning fire that was approaching from the north. Assyria's all-destroying army, which had no gaps and no weakness within it, is represented as a burning fire whose smoke can be seen from a distance. Verse 32 then asks, "How then will one answer the messengers of the nation, that the Lord has founded Zion and the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it?" In other words, it was clear that Assyria would not content itself with a small strip of coast that was Philistia. The acquisition or the conquest of Philistia would be the means or the launching point for further conquests. So the question that is asked in this verse is, how will Judah fare with this firestorm that is headed toward it from the north? Although the answer has already been given in the first part of verse 30, this verse 32 answers directly that Zion belongs to the Lord and it will be protected by the Lord. Although we have the benefit of hindsight and already know the outcome of that serious confrontation of Assyria with Hezekiah, we could already have guessed that Judah would not fall to the Assyrians, because the earlier verses indicate that not just Assyria, but Judah will be the instruments of God's indignation against Philistia. Because we had already looked at most of chapter 14 last week, we already knew the title for these last five verses of the chapter. They describe the oracle or the verdict of God against Philistia. Chapters 15 and 16 contain the oracle or the verdict against Moab. Before we get into these chapters, however, we were asked in the homework to look at some cross-references to fill in the gaps of our knowledge about this nation of Moab. Lot was the nephew of Abraham, and before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, his angels rescued Lot and his wife and two daughters. Lot's wife didn't make it because she looked back, but Lot and his two daughters escaped to a cave near Zoar. The two daughters were worried that their family line would die out, so they got their father drunk, and then each of the daughters slept with her father in turn, and each daughter had a son by their father. The son of the elder daughter was named Moab, and he became the father of the Moabites. The son of the younger daughter was named Ben-Ammi, and he became the father of the Ammonites. This means, of course, that the Moabites and the Israelites were distantly related. The next cross-reference takes us to the book of Ruth, which takes place during a dark time in Israel's history, the time of the judges. Because of a famine in Israel, a man from Bethlehem in Judah, named Elimelech, took his wife Naomi and their two sons into Moab. While they lived there, both sons took Moabite wives, but then all three men died, Elimelech and both sons. Naomi instructed her two Moabite daughters-in-law to return to their families. One did, but the other, Ruth, followed Naomi back to Bethlehem. Cutting a story very short, Ruth the Moabitess married Boaz, a relative of her deceased father-in-law, Elimelech. Ruth and Boaz had a son, Obed, who was the father of Jesse, who was the father of King David. Since Jesus was descended from the line of David, this means that there was a Moabite woman in his family tree. Despite the fact that all of Israel and Moab were distantly related and neighbors as well, there was a long history of conflict between the Israelites and the Moabites. King Saul, the first king of Israel, had dealt with them severely, and David had completely subdued them. After the division of the kingdom, the northern kingdom took possession of Moab, and the Moabites were forced to pay tribute to Samaria. There followed a period of time where the fortunes of the Moabites, vis-a-vis the Israelites, rose and fell. During the time of the reigns of Uzziah and Jotham in Judah, the southern kingdom, there was no conflict with the Moabites that is recorded. But when Ahaz sought help from Assyria, this revived the former hostility, and the Moabites established themselves in settlements north of the Arnon River, land which had been allocated to the tribes of Reuben and Gad. This was how things stood at the time when Isaiah prophesied. Because the Assyrians moved in from the north, they arrived first in the areas north of the Arnon River, areas which the Moabites had only a short time before taken over from the Israelite tribes of Reuben and Gad. Chapter 15 wastes no time on preliminaries. Verse 1 announces that an oracle against Moab is being declared and then says, "Surely in a night, Ayr of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night, Kir of Moab is devastated and ruined." Ayr and Kir were the two main cities of Moab. Ayr was the capital city, but its exact location is debated. Kir is located in the center of Moab. This verse 1 tells us that in the space of one night, meaning very suddenly, Moab would be destroyed. Isaiah's repetition seems to reflect a sense of shock and horror. Verses 2 through 4 describe universal lamentation. Verse 2 describes the people going to the temple and to Dibon, which was the site of a temple to their god Chemosh. And they went there to weep over their idol's inability to save them. Verse 2 says, "They have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba." The grief of every man over the national defeat was demonstrated by the shaving of their heads and of their beards. Verse 3 describes people wailing on their housetops and in the public squares. The K&D commentary says that instead of the original Hebrew simply saying that tears or streams of tears ran down from their eyes, the way the Hebrew is written, it's describing a whole man flowing down to the ground as if he is melting in a stream of tears. Verse 4 names Heshbon and Eleala, two towns that were in the northern part of Moab, and the cry is heard all the way from those towns to Jahaz, which is in the southern part of Moab. The grief and lamentation is without exception. Even the armed men of Moab, the soldiers, will cry aloud in fear as their souls tremble within them. Verse 5 begins by saying, "My heart cries out for Moab." Because Isaiah is speaking aloud the words of the Lord, my first reaction is that this was an expression of the Lord's grief over Moab's coming judgment. Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 11 quotes the Lord as saying, "I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from his way and live." This statement here in Isaiah chapter 15, verse 5, however, may also be an expression of Isaiah's grief. He is called by the Lord to pronounce judgment on a wicked nation, but it grieves him to do so. This emotion is reiterated in chapter 16, verse 9, and I'll include it here because we have just seen two of those cities on the map. "Therefore, I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the wine of Sibmah. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Eleala." The remainder of verse 5 describes the refugees or fugitives heading south from place to place seeking security. Verse 6 describes the pollution of the waters, possibly by the blood of the dead. I got that idea from the fact that verse 9 says that the waters of Dimon are full of blood. Verse 7 describes the refugees or fugitives taking all that they own and crossing the border into Edom. Verse 8 reiterates their wails of distress all over the territory of Moab. The first city listed in verse 8 is in the southwest part of Moab, and the second city listed is diagonally opposite in the northeast part of Moab. This means the verse is saying, from one end of the country to the other, the cry of distress was raised. Verse 9 indicates that there are possibly two causes for the flight of the fugitives. Of course, the first would be the complete devastation of Moab caused by the invading enemy, which in the near future, relative to Isaiah's time, would have been Assyria. But the second and third lines of verse 9 indicate that there will be added woes in the form of a lion upon the fugitives of Moab and upon the remnant of the land. Some commentators indicate that the lion represents another fierce predatory nation, but the K&D commentary indicates that this is similar to the prophecy against Philistia in the last verses of chapter 14. In chapter 14, we saw that after Assyria was used by God to punish Philistia, Judah would again subjugate it. Thus, the lion of chapter 15 might represent Judah generally, because the lion was the emblem of Judah from the time of Jacob's blessing in Genesis chapter 49. I am not expressing an opinion here, except to say that it is certain the judgment of Moab was not yet complete. One title suffices for chapter 15, God's judgment of Moab. This subject continues into chapter 16. Verse 1 says, "Send the tribute lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah by way of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion." On its face, this verse is an instruction to Moab's leaders to send a tribute lamb to Judah, who is characterized as the ruler of the land. Now, we just compared the judgments of Philistia and Moab and saw that a possible similarity was that after God used the Assyrians as his instrument of indignation, then he used his own people, Judah, to subjugate that nation. Thus, it makes sense then that the mountain of the daughter of Zion is the same thing as the ruler of the land. But the following verses, verse 2 through the first part of verse 4, may seem a bit puzzling. This passage compares the refugees to birds hovering at the border of their land, and the refugees are requesting sanctuary in Judah and from the people of Judah to protect them and give them a hiding place from the destroyer, which at the time of Isaiah would, of course, be Assyria. This seems counterintuitive at first glance. If the lion that is described at the end of chapter 15 is the source of the additional woes upon the fugitives of Moab and upon the remnant of the land, then why would the Moabites be turning back to the lion for help and for protection? The answer is that the people of God were Moab's only hope for deliverance. The comparison of the refugees or the fugitives to birds is a good one, because the Moabites were already in flight from their own land. Driven away from their own nest, they were flying in circles, not daring to return to their home, which had been invaded, but they were coming out of hiding and coming close to the borders of their home. On that river boundary that had divided them once from Israel, they sent their petitions to the house of David on the other side. Up to this point, it seems as if these opening 3.5 verses of chapter 16 are describing the devastation and the fear and the flight from the terrifying Assyrians. And they may be. But they must also be describing a future flight, because the latter part of verse 4 and all of verse 5 jump to the time of the messianic rule in the millennial kingdom. Verse 4b says, "For the extortioner has come to an end, destruction has ceased, oppressors have completely disappeared from the land." Verse 5, "A throne will even be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it in faithfulness in the tent of David. Moreover, he will seek justice and be prompt in righteousness." Whatever world power had devastated the people and the land itself had been swept away. Jerusalem is now the glory of the nations. Because of verses 4b and 5 of chapter 16, it seems that Moab will be one of the nations that is described in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, who will go up to the mountain of the Lord to be taught concerning his ways and to learn to walk in his paths. Returning to chapter 16, verses 6 through 12 do not describe the answer of Zion to the petition of the Moabites. Instead, these verses provide a contrast to what we have just read. The first 3.5 verses set out the future repentance and self-abasement of the Moabites as a result of their judgment by the Lord. And that is now contrasted in verses 6 through 12 with their past pride and self-exaltation, which were the cause of God's judgment. In between these two sections, verse 4b and 5, kind of like bridge verses, describe the Messianic kingdom. Verse 6 sets out the common denominator among all these nations against which God is pronouncing a verdict or an oracle through Isaiah. Pride. Look at this list. Pride. An excessive pride. Arrogance. Pride, again. And fury, probably directed against Judah and Israel. And the last in this list of verse 6 are idle and false boasts. Verse 7 of chapter 16 reiterates the theme of chapter 15, that from the top to the bottom of the land, from the north to the south and everywhere in between, there was a universal cry of distress over the fall and the ruin of Moab. They would moan for their raisin cakes, which were probably a specialty and perhaps a famous export. Verse 8 refers to the vines of Sibmah. The wines that were produced by these grapes were so famous and so good that they graced the tables of kings. It was also, however, uncommonly strong, so that it was extremely intoxicating. The K&D commentary states that this Sibmah wine was cultivated throughout Moab. Another unusual feature of this vine was that it was not staked above the ground as most vineyards are seen, but it had trailing vines that ran along the ground. That's the picture that is painted at the end of verse 8, which says that its tendrils spread themselves out and passed over the sea. The point of this verse is that the influence of this wine extended well beyond the borders of Moab. As you can tell from the reference to the raisin cakes and the wine, grapes were the national product of Moab. But the latter part of verse 9 and all of verse 10 describe the destruction of the entire industry by the hostile invaders sent by the Lord in judgment. For the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away, and gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. No treader treads out wine in the presses, for I have made the shouting to cease. Verse 11 repeats the theme of verse 9, which we also saw earlier in chapter 15, verse 5. All three of those verses express the grief of Isaiah, and probably of the Lord as well, over the coming judgment and destruction of Moab. Look at the phrase in verse 11, in tones like a harp. This is describing the vibration of a stringed instrument when the strings are plucked. The metaphor is that Isaiah is the sounding board of the instrument, and that the vision that the Lord is giving him causes his heart to resonate, to vibrate in sympathy with the coming suffering of the Moabites. What a clear description of sympathy and empathy. Verse 12 continues with a description of the lostness of the Moabites that broke Isaiah's heart. When the Moabites would go to their high places where their idols were, and when they would weary themselves with petitions to these dead idols, there would be, of course, no response. Verses 13 and 14 were apparently added later. these verses say, "This is the word which the Lord spoke earlier concerning Moab." Verse 14, "But now the Lord speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all his great population, and his remnant will be very small and impotent." What is it that these verses are telling us? So far, we have seen two oracles against nations other than Israel. The oracle against Philistia was in chapter 14, verses 28 to 32, and the oracle against Moab was in chapters 15 and 16. I think we can assume that both of these were given to Isaiah in the year that Ahaz died. But then, at some point later, the Lord gave Isaiah additional revelation, which was that what had been prophesied would be fulfilled in exactly 3 years. The problem is that no one knows how much later the additional revelation was given, so no one can calculate the starting point of the 3 years. We know that the near fulfillment of the destruction of Moab was by the Assyrians, but whether it was under Shalmaneser, Sargon, or Sennacherib, no one knows. The title for chapter 16 would be God's Judgment of Moab Continued. Chapter 17 is a new subject, the oracle concerning Damascus. Damascus was the capital city of Aram or Syria, so that means that this is a verdict or a judicial sentence against Syria. However, we have only to get to verse 2 to realize that this is also a verdict against Israel, the northern kingdom, because it allied itself with Syria against Judah, where the throne of the house of David was. Chapter 17 begins. The oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus is about to be removed from being a city, and it will become a fallen ruin. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They will be for flocks to lie down in, and there will be no one to frighten them. The first clue we have that this verdict is also against the northern kingdom of Israel is the phrase, the cities of Aroer. This city, Aroer, is to the east of the Dead Sea, just north of the Arnon River. That's in Israel's territory, although we know from prior chapters that the Moabites possessed it for a while. Commentators differ on what this reference to the cities of Aroer means. Barnes Notes and Matthew Henry say that this was also the name of a province in Syria, and that therefore verse 2 is still talking about Syria. The KND commentary take the position that the phrase refers to the cities east of the Jordan, and therefore, although verse 1 is against Syria, verse 2 is against Israel, and verse 3 is against both. Both Syrians and Israelites were taken into captivity by the Assyrians under Tiglath-Pileser. Verses 4 through 8 address Israel only, although it appears to include the southern kingdom of Judah as well as the northern kingdom of Israel. The prosperity that both divisions of the kingdom had enjoyed under Jeroboam II in the north and under Uzziah and Jotham in the south, was ripe for picking by invaders. The Assyrians would come and reap the population like the reaper gathering the standing grain. Nevertheless, the Lord would leave a remnant. These are represented by the gleanings that are left after the harvest of olives, first by hand and then by the shaking of the tree. And then, according to verses 7 and 8, this remnant of Israel will finally turn away from idolatry and will have regard for his Maker, and his eyes will look to the Holy One of Israel. Notice the contrast of this verse to chapter 1, verse 4, which describes the sons of Israel as those who have despised the Holy One of Israel. As with the oracle against Moab, there appears to be a jump from Isaiah's time to the very end times. In fact, this chapter 17 seems to follow the pattern of chapter 16. You will recall that in chapter 16, the first 3.5 verses describe the future repentance and self-abasement of the Moabites as a result of their judgment by the Lord. Although this would occur in the near future relative to Isaiah's time, it also appears to have a far fulfillment, particularly in light of the bridge verses, verses 4b and 5, which jump to a description of the Messianic kingdom. This was followed by a description, on the other hand, the contrast of the pride of Moab, which had led to their judgment by God, who used another nation as his instrument of indignation. Verses 6 through 12 then described the devastation and destruction of Moab. That's chapter 16. Here, in chapter 17, we are seeing the same pattern of contrast. The first 6 verses appear to be describing the future judgment of Syria and of northern Israel, and possibly also Judah, in the time of Isaiah, in which case the instrument of indignation in God's hand would be Assyria. The possible inclusion of Judah, however, in verses 4 through 6 seems to indicate a broader perspective, because we know that the southern kingdom was not carried off into captivity by Babylon, not Assyria, but Babylon, until almost 150 years later. Thus, it is also possible that these first 6 verses of chapter 17 apply to a judgment or refinement in the case of Israel at the very end times. Following the pattern of chapter 16, after these initial verses, which could apply to Isaiah's time and which could also apply to the very end times, we have 2 verses that clearly apply to the Messianic kingdom of the millennium. These are verses 7 and 8 in chapter 17. Immediately after those beautiful verses, just as in chapter 16, chapter 17, verses 9 through 11, go backward to the past and describe why the judgments were necessary. It was because they had turned away from the Lord and tried to be self-sufficient. Verse 9c says, "And the land will be a desolation." Why? The answer is in the very next verse, verse 10. "For you have forgotten the God of your salvation and have not remembered the rock of your refuge." The remainder of verse 10 and verse 11 have at least 2 possible interpretations, but they are not inconsistent with one another. Let's look at the verses first. "Therefore," meaning because they had forgotten the God of their salvation, "you plant delightful plants and set them with vine slips of a strange God. In the day that you plant it, you carefully fence it in, and in the morning you bring your seed to blossom. But the harvest will be a heap in a day of sickliness and incurable pain." One possible interpretation of these verses is that the Israelites were following a pagan custom that was intended to obtain the favor of their false gods, their idols, the strange gods. But another is that this could be a metaphor for the alliance with Syria. An alliance with Syria seemed to be a delightful thing to Israel, and so Israel planted the seed, which flowered quickly into the plot, catch the double meaning, the play on words, plot, that the Syrians and the Israelites made together to launch a joint attack upon Judah. But the harvest of that plot would be desolation at the hand of the Lord, sickliness and incurable pain. Verses 12 through 14 of chapter 17 do not have a parallel to chapter 16. These 3 verses describe the destruction of the destroyer. In Isaiah's time, that would be Assyria. But these verses seem to be more geared toward the end times because it speaks of the uproar of many peoples and nations, plural. Because they appear to be acting in unity, this may be a superpower whose predecessor in Isaiah's time would defeat Syria and Israel. These verses describe the terror of many warriors advancing in concert, like roaring waves, one after another, crashing onto the beach. Or perhaps the image we are meant to visualize is that of a tidal wave overwhelming the land. The point is that it is a seemingly unstoppable force until we get to the word but. Verse 13 says, "But he," meaning the Lord, of course, "will rebuke them, and they will flee far away and be chased like chaff in the mountains before the wind or like whirling dust before a gale." Verse 14 continues, "At evening time, behold, there is terror. Before morning, they are no more." These many nations, all gathered together with all their resources united, launch a common attack upon Israel. But a word from the Lord, a mere rebuke, and this massive wall of water dissolves into spray, which blows away like chaff in the mountains before the wind or like whirling dust before a gale. In the space of one night, the terror is gone. The chapter ends with a cry of triumph from Israel. "Such will be the portion of those who plunder us and the lot of those who pillage us." And once more, the theme that has been developing in Isaiah is driven home. All the nations, whether singly or united together, no matter how terrifying, are subject to the sovereign Lord of all creation. The title for chapter 17 is God's Judgment of Syria and Israel. Chapter 18 does not begin as an oracle against a particular nation. Some Bibles which add descriptive titles to passages will call this chapter an oracle concerning Cush. I looked that up. It's actually pronounced Cush. But frankly, I cannot see that this is about Cush. What I see is that there is the Lord's judgment of some nation. My best guess is that it is Assyria. And this judgment has an effect upon that land which lies beyond the rivers of Cush, but is not Cush itself. But let's begin with Cush, since it is the only nation that is named. The first question is, where was Cush? The bottom line is that the answer depends upon which commentary you are reading. Here are some of the possibilities. This is a map which I copied from the software program that I use. It's called PC Study Bible. This map places Cush in what is known as Upper Egypt. Apparently, because the Nile River runs from south to north until it empties into the Mediterranean Sea, Upper Egypt is south of Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt is the area of the Nile Delta where the river empties into the sea. According to Barnes notes, some portion of Upper Egypt, so that's south, is intended by the reference to Cush in verse 1 of Isaiah chapter 18. That would coincide nicely with this particular map. Another possible location for Cush, however, is southern Arabia, primarily along the coast of the Red Sea. Several passages in Scripture seem to indicate that Cush, or Cushan, was a country adjacent to Midian. Midian was located here, and some scholars therefore think that Cush was located just south of it, along the coast of the Red Sea. Chapter 18 begins, "Alas, O land of whirring wings which lies beyond the rivers of Cush." What do the whirring wings refer to? I think immediately of hummingbirds because you can even hear their whirring wings. But I think we can safely say that's not what is meant here. Again, however, it depends upon which commentary you are consulting. The whirring wings might represent swarming hordes of people, as in the sense of advancing armies, or they might represent the sails of ships as they are seen from a distance, or they might represent swarms of locusts or mosquitoes. Certainly, Egypt and Ethiopia swarmed with insects on account of the abundance of water and the intense heat there. Indeed, this fact that Egypt and Ethiopia swarmed with insects might be the reason that Isaiah used the whirring wings to represent swarming hordes of people. Just looking at what we have so far, a description of the land of whirring wings, a land which lies beyond the rivers of Cush, indicates to me that this land is something other than the nation of Cush. If we assume that Cush is located either in Upper Egypt or just south of it, then beyond the rivers of Cush would refer to a region near modern Ethiopia. Whatever this exotic land is, it sends envoys by the sea. But Isaiah sends these envoys, these swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide. So what do we have in only two verses? First, we have the only nation that is named, and that is Cush. But it appears to be used only as a point of reference for the unnamed nations. Second, there is the land of whirring wings that lies beyond the rivers of Cush, and it sends envoys by the sea in papyrus vessels on the surface of the waters. These envoys, these swift messengers, are being directed to go to what may be a third nation, one that is described as a nation tall and smooth, a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the waters divide. Fourth, there is the nation that is being judged in verses 4 through 6. Since Cush is used as a point of reference, the land of whirring wings that lies beyond it might be Egypt or it might be Ethiopia, but I can't rule out Assyria as a possibility, especially if the location of Cush is near Midian in Arabia. The nation tall and smooth seems to describe Egypt. The Egyptians were known to shave the hair off their bodies so that their skin was smooth. Moreover, they were a people feared far and wide. Certainly the Israelites had a history of being oppressed by them. And the branches of the Nile divided the land. If this third nation is describing Egypt or perhaps Ethiopia, then we need to consider the possibility that number 2 and number 3 are the same nation. In other words, that the land of whirring wings is the same as the nation tall and smooth. In that case, then, the envoys are messengers that were sent out from the land of whirring wings that lies beyond the rivers of Cush, but the direction that Isaiah gives is for them to return home to their nation tall and smooth. As to the nation being judged in verses 4 through 6, my best guess is Assyria in Isaiah's time and some form of successor of Assyria in the very end time. Allow me to read you something about the secular history of Isaiah's time that was set out in the K&D commentary. On page 226, the authors wrote, and I'm partially quoting but partially paraphrasing, "At that time, both Egypts, upper and lower, were governed by the Ethiopian dynasty. The Ethiopian monarch, Sabaco, had made himself master of the country on the lower Nile." That's the Nile Delta, where the Nile empties into the sea. "The king of Egypt, who was contemporaneous with Sennacherib of Assyria, was the Tirhaka of the Old Testament." Now, that's the end of the quote or the paraphrase. they don't explain why there is a king of Egypt at the same time that both Egypts, lower and upper, are being governed by the Ethiopian dynasty. But we have seen examples in the Old Testament of countries being conquered by another. The king is allowed to continue to sit on the throne, and then the nation must pay tribute to the conquering nation. The commentary, K&D, also says that the Ethiopian kingdom, which I suppose would include or encompass Egypt, is thrown into the greatest excitement in the face of the approaching Assyrian invasion, and the messengers are sent out to raise the militia. That's the end of the quote. This commentary also says that the strange description that's given in both verses 2 and 7 of the Ethiopian people is based on their universal reputation in antiquity of gigantic strength and invincibility. If we accept that the land of whirring wings, which was adjacent to the nation of Cush, was an Ethiopian dynasty that also governed both Upper and Lower Egypt, then the description of verses 2 and 7 would describe either the Ethiopians themselves or the Egyptian under their rule. If this is the case, then the message that Isaiah is conveying to these swift messengers, these envoys, is to return home. And the reason is given in verse 3. The Lord will call all the nations of the world to battle as the Lord uses them to destroy Assyria. Just as we saw in chapter 13, there will be the signal, the call to battle. In chapter 13, there were three signals given. The standard or the banner was raised on the mountains for everyone to see. A loud call was given, and a hand was waved to gesture to the peoples to come. Here in chapter 18, there are two signals. The first is that the standard or banner will be raised on the mountains and all the nations will see it. The second is that a trumpet will be blown and all the nations will hear. In other words, because the Lord himself was about to deliver the world from the conquering might of Assyria, Isaiah was giving the word to the Ethiopian/Egyptian kingdom, which was in the process of sending out envoys to gather others to join them in self-defense, to send their messengers home. The judgment of the Lord of, I assume, Assyria, is described in verses 4 through 6, and once more it seems to have overtones of the end time judgment. Let's read these verses first and then take them a little at a time. For thus the Lord has told me, I will look from my dwelling place quietly, like dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, as soon as the bud blossoms and the flower becomes a ripening grape, then he will cut off the sprigs with pruning knives and remove and cut away the spreading branches. They will be left together for mountain birds of prey and for the beasts of the earth, and the birds of prey will spend the summer feeding on them, and all the beasts of the earth will spend harvest time on them. The dazzling heat in the sunshine is a picture of the shimmering heat of summer. The cloud of dew in the heat of harvest is a picture of a mist in the approaching autumn. One commentator, I think it was Constable, indicated that both of these are images of coming judgment. The footnotes in my ESV Bible had a different, although not necessarily inconsistent, take. These footnotes said, working as silently as heat or dew, God frustrates human attempts at securing the world without him. He watches until the moment is right and then acts. This is the truth underlying the appearance of human might in history. Verse 5 indicates that it is a premature harvest. The Lord is saying that he will prune the crops before they had time to mature. Perhaps his judgment would be perceived as premature by those who are being judged. In any event, the judgment would be surely unexpected. What is the crop that will be prematurely cut off? It is the might of Assyria. The Lord will watch quietly as he allows it to develop and to grow, and then, Before it reaches full maturity, he will move swiftly and suddenly cut it off completely. The pruning, however, will be so severe that, unlike the reaping of the population of Israel, in which a remnant will be left, this harvest by the Lord will apparently leave nothing left. Verse 6 says that the harvest of people, represented by the spreading branches, will be left for mountain birds of prey and for the beasts of the earth. And the birds of prey will spend the summer feeding on them, and all the beasts of the earth will spend harvest time on them. This verse echoes the passage out of Revelation chapter 19, verses 17 and 18, which say, "And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, Come, assemble for the great supper of God, in order that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses and of those who sit on them and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves and great and small." The last verse of Isaiah chapter 18 describes the effect that the Lord's judgment of Assyria has on the nation tall and smooth. Ethiopia or Egypt submits itself to the Lord. This verse 7 is also a reference to the very end of times. The once powerful and feared nation of verse 2 will worship the Lord and bring gifts of homage to Jerusalem. This nation will be among the others that go up the mountain to worship at Jerusalem, as described in Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Twice in verse 7, Isaiah uses the name the Lord of hosts. This serves to emphasize the sovereignty of the Lord Jehovah over all nations throughout human history. If we are the generation that is alive during those tumultuous and terrifying final 7 years of this age, then let us remember this enigmatic chapter 18 of Isaiah, especially verses 4 through 6. When the whole world is under the control of the Antichrist, and when it seems that pure evil has truly triumphed and prevailed, then we must remember that the Lord looks down from his dwelling place quietly. Like dazzling heat, the shimmering heat of summer, and like a cloud of dew or mist in autumn. Behind the scenes, our Jehovah, our sovereign Lord, works as silently as heat or dew. He is never unaware, and he is always in control. Since he knows about the little drops of moisture on plants in the early morning, we can be assured that he knows every last small detail of our lives. And our only hope and our only security lies in trusting him. I found it very difficult to come up with a title for chapter 18. And you wouldn't think that would be such a problem when a chapter had only 7 verses. To me, this chapter 18 was an example of how the nations are subject to God. But to make it more specific, I wrote, God's judgment of Assyria and the effect of that judgment on Ethiopia/Egypt. The words of our final hymn were written by William A. Dunkerley in 1914. Lord God of hosts, whose mighty hand dominion holds on sea and land, in peace and war your will we see shaping the larger liberty. Nations may rise and nations fall, your changeless purpose rules them all. For those who weak and broken lie in weariness and agony, great healer to their beds of pain, come touch and make them whole again. O, hear a people's prayer and bless your servants in their hour of stress. For those to whom the call shall come, we pray your tender welcome home. The toil, the bitterness all past, we trust them to your love at last. O, hear a people's prayers for all who nobly striving, nobly fall. For those who minister and heal and spend themselves, their skill, their zeal, renew their hearts with Christ-like faith and guard them from disease and death. And in your own good time, Lord, send your peace on earth till time shall end. Amen.